Uh-oh, shooting for some crude.
Well, the first thing you know, old Jed's a millionaire. The kinfolk said, Jed, move away from there. Said, California is the place you ought to be. So they loaded up the truck and they moved to Beverly Hills, that is.
You know it and I know it. Striking oil has gotten a lot harder since Jed Clampett took Granny and Jethro to California. It's Alaska's black gold that has replaced the Texas tea. Oil men on the North Slope, they're the elbow grease of the carbon economy. We're going to meet them on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 9th, and the story that we're going to hear about couldn't be further from Beverly Hills, John.
That's true. Good morning, Adora.
Just warning you. We're looking at all banks also today, great and small, from Wall Street to West Virginia, plus Patchwork Nation, a look at the 22 million people who live in communities that our friend Dante Chinte has called Minority Central. Those stories are coming up, but first, some headlines.
All right, our partners at the New York Times are reporting this morning that the U.S. Treasury may take ownership stakes in some U.S. banks. The Treasury can do that now under the $700 billion rescue plan that was passed last week. This is similar to moves Britain is making, where the government gives money to banks in return for shares in them. An SEC ban on short selling ended last night. Short selling is where investors bet on a company's value falling. Investors were critical of the SEC rule and say the ban did little to stabilize the markets, although the markets are looking pretty stable this morning.
Yeah, overseas, European investors have been in a buying mood today. Markets in the UK and France have posted gains. Asian markets were a mixed bag. Japan's Nikkei index closed slightly down, while Hong Kong and South Korea's markets gained. Insurance giant AIG is getting some more help from the federal government. The Fed announced yesterday it will loan nearly $38 billion more to the insurer. Last month, the government bailout of the failing company with a $85 billion loan.
So we own AIG, we own some new banks, and of course there's the Federal Reserve, Fannie, Freddie Mac, you know, federal ATMs next on your block. French novelist Jean-Marie Gustave Leclésio is the latest winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. The Academy praised his, quote, poetic adventure and sensual ecstasy. The prize is worth $1.4 million, and Leclésio has been writing since he was 8 years old, first published at age 23. On the campaign trail, John McCain and Sarah Palin campaigned together in Wisconsin. Barack Obama's in Ohio, while Joe Biden swings through Missouri.
And tonight, the Philadelphia Phillies host the L.A. Dodgers in the first game of baseball's National League Championship Series. The Dow dropped 2% yesterday to close at 92.58. The S&P lost a bit more than 1% at 9.84. Oil settled around $88 a barrel in Asian trading.
You didn't say go Joe Torre. You always say that
I
when
didn't.
You talk about the Dodgers.
Well, I think it's a good day to be Joe Torre.
It's a good day to be
you
Joe
know,
Torre.
You get kicked out of the Yankees. Next thing you know, you're in Los Angeles and you're taking a run at the championship.
Joe Torre's not worried about health care, although he's a cancer survivor, so maybe he is. What do you think?
I believe we miss it when we start talking about whether it's a right or a responsibility. It is something that we need, and I think it's a need and a burden that we share. So I think we should put it as such.
Talking about healthcare on The Takeaway at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Is it a right or a responsibility? Your thoughts.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Getting it right is as important as getting it done quickly. We can and we will do both.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson at an afternoon press conference yesterday outlining more steps the government is taking to intervene in the financial markets. And after a day of nervous selling and all kinds of financial neurosis, the markets appear to be embracing stability this morning and taking Henry Paulson at his word. They want it done right if it's not going to be done quickly. The markets have not been wildly fluctuating like yesterday. It's the day after the unprecedented coordinated interest rate cut by the Federal Reserve, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, and the Bank of China. Other banks have followed suit over the last 24 hours. U.S. futures on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500, those futures are up today after a six-day losing streak, which saw indices in the U.S. falling by more than 15%. Today, the Bush administration is also reportedly considering taking ownership stakes in a number of U.S. banks, in addition to what we already own, actually offering money to the banks in return for an ownership stake. That's much like the U.K. did yesterday. With all that to talk about, Michael Hunter joins us from London. He's a markets reporter for the Financial Times. Michael, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, John. Good morning.
So a couple of things. Describe this arrangement. We certainly heard about it yesterday in London, that money is being offered by the British Treasury. And if banks take it, then they have to give up some sort of ownership stake to the government in London. But in Washington, is it going to work the same sort of way?
Well, we're not entirely sure what the Washington idea will be, how closely based on the what's now being referred to already as the British model, the Washington plans will be. But in terms of the British model, effectively, it's going to make the government a major holder of preferential stock in a series of UK high street lenders. According to one measure, when we've thrown a slide rule over the numbers as much as we can do at the moment, it would mean every taxpayer in the UK effectively holding about £1,600 worth of stock per capita in the banks. Now, the government's hoping that once the system is restored to something like normal, those preferential shares which it holds will rise in value, and the taxpayer should get much of the money put into the scheme back, if not all of it. And if it all goes really well, they could even see some kind of a profit in the long term.
Now, does that make you feel better as a taxpayer to be this sort of abstract shareholder who might get it right?
I think there's a lot of anger on the high street, similar to the kind of outcry that you saw over there in the States with the original Paulson bailout plan when that failed to get through the House of Representatives. But I think there's also a growing realization that people are aware that something really does need to be done, that we're looking at the kind of systemic crisis, you know, not seen since the war.
And certainly psychologically, the idea of personal savings accounts as an alternative to Social Security is a barrier that we've already crossed in the United States, this idea that the government would take ownership stakes. But let's review the bidding a little bit, Michael. I mean, we've got an insurance company, an AIG, that's owned by Washington, right? We've got now these banks that are being owned. We've got the Federal Reserve. I mean, what's next? ATMs by the federal government? It's a full-service economic institution, the federal government is. That seems pretty broad.
Well, I think what's happening is you're seeing the extent to which the hitherto private international financial system has to be underwritten by government. We're seeing that very, very clearly demonstrated with these changes in ownership, these nationalizations, governments taking shares in large hitherto private financial institutions, savings being underwritten around Europe and elsewhere in the world. And that shows you really exactly how national government really has always underpinned this system. And the way in which the private development of the system, the development of the system in private hands has failed, brings back to mind the central role that government really has always had to play in the system in setting interest rates, right, in underwriting it all.
Well,
it,
of course, it, not always playing that role.
Well,
I mean, at the turn of the 20th century, the private sector was really bailed out by the federal government the United States.
I think that's true.
And now we're seeing it on a global scale, it seems like.
We're also becoming, I think, a little bit more aware of the point at which market economics can't function on its own.
Right.
And when we've lost the degree of clarity which has always existed in traditional banking and things have become too complicated, the confusion that creates means governments have had to step in. And I think one of the main lessons we'll learn from the crisis is you can't have a situation where the only people who understand complex debt and financial instruments are the people who have written them and the people who are selling them to each other. I don't think regulators will let that happen again.
Right. Michael Hunter, markets reporter for the Financial Times, talking about the possibility of a broad democratization of the financial sector with all these transformations that are taking place. Question, Michael, thanks for joining us, by the way, from London.
My pleasure.
And question, is there any place where banking is simple?
No, exactly. As they struggle on Wall Street and topple, we wondered how smaller banks are doing on Main Street. And right now we have Mike Nelson, president and CEO of Pleasants County Bank in St. Mary's, West Virginia, on the line. Good morning and welcome, Mike.
Good morning.
So in the face of this meltdown on Wall Street, how is business in West Virginia?
Stable, secure, and I think the customers in our marketplace are leery and afraid of course, of all the media attention and all the drama they're seeing on television.
What makes your bank different from those who are really suffering from the collapses at the moment?
Well, Pleasants County Bank is a community bank, and we've been in St. Mary's, well, for 112 years now. And Pleasants County Bank is different from the large investment banks in that we deal directly right here in our community. We take local deposits, and we make local mortgage loans, automobile loans, and business loans. And when we put our loans on our books, we keep them to maturity or until they pay off or they're refinanced in some way.
So you're talking about a more conservative investment, but let me ask you this. Are people paying their mortgages and other loans?
Right now, yes. In West Virginia, I think we have a pretty good, stable banking environment. I'm not going to say that we're going to be insulated from a national or global recession. Our valley has quite a few chemical plants and coal-fired electric generating plants. And I think, you know, if this recession trickles down to the chemical plants in our valley and there's layoffs, and I think, you know, we're going to see some of the downturn also.
So that's really what you're watching for, is how the unemployment rate does in your state.
Exactly.
You know, I wonder, Mike, you're on a first-name basis with the guys who are paying your mortgages, right?
Oh, yes, we are.
I mean, you could probably rattle off a couple of first names of people who are paying, right?
Yes, and I'll tell you, they're concerned about their deposits. The best thing that came out of the relief bill for community banks, not only in West Virginia and probably nationwide, was the increase in the FDIC insurance. That went a long way to stabilize a lot of fears in our community.
Because are you spending a lot of your time reassuring your customers, and what kind of questions do they have?
I've spent a good part of my day the last 2 or 3 weeks reassuring customers. The difference, trying to reassure customers the difference between the word bank in investment bank and community bank.
Have you had to use the word casino to describe what's going on Wall Street?
Cha-ching, no, not yet.
So in terms of the wider bailout plan, what do you think of it beyond the FDIC insurance going up? Are there other ways where it affects how you do business every day?
Not as much as it will in the larger cities and the larger markets. I understand the need to return cash flow nationwide and around the world to some type of a semblance of order, and between a lot of the larger banks, and I think, you know, we hear this on the national news. I mean, there's been a loss of trust in the banking business between banks, because no one knows who's going to be the next large failure or the next one that gets gobbled up because they're having problems.
And given that question of trust, have you had fewer applications for loans in the last days and weeks?
Oh, yes. I think it's been I think the process has really slowed down over probably the last 6 months. But really in the last month, it just seems like a lot of things have almost come to a complete halt. But there's still people out there buying some automobiles, mm-hmm. and we still have a few applications for people doing some remodeling and buying some homes.
Okay, Mike Nelson, thanks for joining us this morning. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mike Nelson is the president and CEO of Pleasants County Bank in St. Mary's, West Virginia.
It's great to talk to somebody who actually knows who is paying on the mortgages he owns in the bank, unlike these, you know, credit default swaps where nobody even knows what they are.
I know, sterile, nameless, faceless.
Well, speaking of simplicity in financial transactions, the campaign is talking about health care and changing the health care system. Do you think health care is a right, a fundamental right, or a personal responsibility? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
If education is a right in this country, why isn't healthcare a right as well?
What do you think about healthcare? It seems like we've been talking about healthcare and the U.S. economy for decades because we have been doing just that. It's that important. And it's an issue in the campaign this time around as well. Should the government get more involved in healthcare? How have your healthcare options affected you and your family's life? Right or responsibility? That's the question. 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
And, John, today we are going to get another chapter in what our friend Dante Cheney calls our patchwork nation. It really involves looking past whether a state is Democratic or Republican. And it's a project he directs for the Christian Science Monitor. The latest chapter today is what he calls Minority Central, looking at communities with large pockets of African Americans and also communities with large pockets of Native American voters. Good morning, Dante, and welcome back, as always.
Good morning, and thanks.
So describe what Minority Central means in your definition.
Well, Minority Central, the way we define it is these African-American and Native American communities around the country, counties with large African-American and Native American populations. They tend to be slightly below the average median household income, and they're places that are dealing a lot with issues of race and a lot with issues of poverty.
And essentially, you're really describing pockets within counties, 408 of them, actually, that potentially are majority white, but you have these pockets of people of color.
That's absolutely right, yeah.
And so what are some of the issues that you've come across they have in common, both those that have pockets of Native American populations and those that have pockets of African American populations?
Well, obviously, when you're dealing with these places, if you look on the map to even where they sit on the website, these are places. A lot of these places are dealing with poverty as a big issue, and disparities. There are real income disparities between the people, the haves and the have-nots in these places. Even though the median household income in these places is below the national average, there are exceptions. There are places where people are doing a little better.
Well, let's listen to a bit of an interview of someone who's working with you, Ed Pratt, who's a media relations director at Southern University in Baton Rouge, and he's a blogger for the Patchwork Nation Project.
You have communities here where the immediacy of a problem is more important than this longer-term problem. The cost of food, the cost of gas, the cost of buying a new car, the cost of maintaining a home. Those things affect the communities here more than you would probably think the collapse on Wall Street.
So he's describing how these communities would relate to the big stories of what's happening on Wall Street. How also do they differ from other communities?
Well, the one thing that's really been interesting looking at these places and places like them, we have a couple different types of communities where the incomes are a little lower is, economically, these places have been hit all year long by the slowdown. So the Wall Street thing that's happening now, which is a huge issue, obviously, these are places where people don't have as many 401ks or a lot of stock. So they've been feeling it all along in the things that Ed's talking about. The other issues they face are, like other poorer communities, education is a very big issue in places like this. And trying to help the next generation climb out of the situation they're in, and it's not easy. There isn't a lot of money to really make the schools better in these places.
Are there particular issues in those places where you have African American pockets that differ from those communities where you have Native American pockets?
Yeah, well, the racial issues are obviously different. I mean, we ended up having to group these two types of places together, Native American and African American counties, just because when we created these things, we had to keep the number of groups somewhat limited, or it was just going to become extremely difficult to handle. The majority of these places are places with large African American populations, but the difference is obviously, you know, going, because I do get out west and I go through some of the communities where you have large Native American populations, the tensions are nothing like what you have, you know, when you, especially down when you get into the deep south between blacks and whites.
And that's where Ed Pratt is. He's down in Baton Rouge. And how does that play itself out when you're talking about communities where you have working class whites and blacks living together and basically competing for the same economic resources?
Right. It's, you know, and that's really what drives all the tension in these places. Because the places aren't well off, you've got, you know, you've got people essentially, but all of them kind of struggling to kind of make it. And what happens in those kind of situations, obviously, is when you can't make it, you start looking at maybe, you know, quote unquote, why you can't make it. And I think a lot of times the tendency is to point to the, you know, the person that's not like you. And I think that that's one reason, and I'm sure Ed would agree with this, you know, why the tensions run so high in places like Baton Rouge.
Just real quickly, in terms of the election, how do these racial tensions play out when you have an African-American running for president in the Democratic Party?
That's really going to be interesting to see. That's really what we, that's one of the things we want to find out. Baton Rouge, we think, in these minority central communities. In the past, these places, because they're majority white, have tended to go Republican. The question is, what happens now when you have a, Barack Obama on the ticket? Can they drive up the African-American turnout enough to maybe flip some of these places?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, obviously, it's going to be interesting to talk to Ed afterwards, just what the atmosphere was like down in Baton Rouge on that day.
All right. Well, we're going to keep your number on our Rolodex, Dante.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Dante Chinney, the director of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation Project. Now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got the morning's headlines.
Thank you very much. It is 28 minutes past the hour. The ban on short selling is over. The ban was intended to be a timeout to allow markets time to recover from the recent turmoil. The ban ended last night, and the general view was that it only added to confusion about the economic situation. Citigroup and Wells Fargo will have two more days to negotiate the fate of Wachovia. A district judge granted an extension. Both groups are concerned about acquiring low-value assets from Wachovia. In Iceland, authorities say that their takeover of the country's last remaining independent bank. It's the third such takeover in recent days. The country has decided to suspend trading on its stock exchange until Monday. And in Europe, governments of France, Belgium and Luxembourg have agreed to give the European lender Dexia a year-long guarantee, from banking to baseball. The National League Championship Series kicks off tonight in Philadelphia. The Phillies host the LA Dodgers in Game 1, and the ALCS starts tomorrow in Tampa Bay as the upstart Rays take on the Red Sox. And staying with sport, love him or hate him, the cycling world is ready for Lance Armstrong to return to professional racing.
Who hates Lance?
Oh, I don't know. Do we hear any sound effects in the background?
I just wondered.
Cycling's Lance. Governing body has
car,
even relaxed its rules to allow Armstrong to race in Australia in January. Now, normally you have to be registered with the US
right.
Anti-Doping Agency for 6 months. And now if Lance Armstrong races in January, he would only have been registered for 4 months. Now, the agency is actually saying that because doping detection has got so good now, that 4 months is plenty of time.
That's good. I'm glad that Lance
put that story in just for you.
Everything.
Did you enjoy that, John?
With Lance, yes.
Good.
Buy a car, Lance.
That's your news.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Today we're asking you to join in the conversation about health care in this country.
I think it's just the Americans to control their own insurance, but it's up to the government to help them, support them, especially the ones who are disabled like I am. I'm not just a disabled body. I am an enabled body who can do more things than what the government allows me to.
So here's the question. Should the government get involved in healthcare? Is it a personal responsibility or is it a right? Give us a call and give us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can always drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. John?
A little economic news here before we begin. Jobless claims have pulled back from a seven-year high. The estimate is that hurricane impacts have faded, and that is the result of that, but certainly one of the most important watched statistics. Healthcare, which Adora mentioned a moment ago, is one of the issues driving this campaign. It's one of the issues we want to explore between now and Election Day. And joining us is Mark Pauley, who's a health economist at the Wharton School. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
I want to tee up two statements from the candidates to set the broad issues and see if there's enough contrast there to actually develop some kind of actual policy debate here. First, listen to John McCain, Mark.
I think it's a responsibility in this respect, in that we should have available and affordable health care to every American citizen.
John McCain saying health care is a responsibility and that it should be available for everyone, regardless of their health condition. Now, listen to this story that Barack Obama told the other night.
I think it should be a right for every American. In a country as wealthy as ours, for us to have people who are going bankrupt because they can't pay their medical bills. For my mother to die of cancer at the age of 53 and have to spend the last months of her life in a hospital room arguing with insurance companies because they're saying that this may be a pre-existing condition and they don't have to pay her treatment, there's something fundamentally wrong about that.
Okay, Mark, so Barack Obama talks about health care at the extremes, and certainly the tragic death of his mother is an extreme case, but an all-too-familiar case. And John McCain seems to be talking from more of a market perspective. Do these reflect two very, very different views of a health care system managed by the federal government?
I think they reflect different views of how they would structure the healthcare system, although I think the differences that would matter to ordinary citizens are much smaller than the ideological differences between the candidates.
So Obama's plan would actually broaden the number of people who are insured, yet it would still leave a number of individuals uninsured. How do you view, first of all, the cost of this plan and who it would primarily affect?
Well, the cost of the plan is somewhat debatable because the cost estimates depend in part on some assumptions made about improvements in efficiency, which I'm an optimist about, but we can't give guarantees that things like greater use of information technology and computers would lower costs and other things like that. I think the realistic take that you would have to have for either candidate's plan is that if you are a middle-class person who's paying taxes, you'll probably end up paying more taxes to reduce the number of uninsured people under either candidate's plan.
But under the Obama plan, as a medical consumer, would your life be simpler? Would you be having fewer arguments with insurance companies, that sort of thing?
In part, it depends on who you are. If you were in the situation of Obama's mother or the gentleman who you played the little clip for, that people in that situation would be much better off because the Obama plan will require insurers to accept high risks and provide them with at least some approved coverage. And so the people that we usually think of as most adversely affected by being uninsured, who are high risks, would have their situation substantially improved under the Obama plan. I need to say, however, that under McCain, although he proposes to do it differently, a person in that situation would also be in much better shape than now because McCain proposes to, working with the states, have a heavily subsidized so-called high-risk pool, where if you're a high risk, you basically would be entitled to get decent insurance coverage at a premium for you that that is affordable. In both cases, the people at high risk are actually would be in much better shape under either candidate's plan than at present.
Let's take apart the McCain strategy on these high-risk pools. Mm-hmm. Basically, you're putting groups of people who share medical characteristics together and subsidizing the cost of serving them to the point where an actual insurance program can exist. Is that a good strategy, or does it actually just aggregate the highest costs?
Well, the high-cost people are going to be high-cost no matter where you put them together. So I think the thing to be said in favor of that strategy is that it puts them in a situation where tax money, subsidized money, can actually be targeted to them, specifically to their need.
Now, when we talk to healthcare providers about the current system, which is a mix of private and public sector, nobody describes the system as simple in any way. Republicans like to say that a market-driven system is going to be more simple because it will be self-sustaining, whereas Democrats and people who are supporting a single-payer program say that will be a simpler approach. Do you think there's any clarity here?
Well, Obama is not supporting a single-payer system or single-player system, depending on your point of view. I guess it depends on how you look at it. In both cases, people would have a choice of a variety of plans. The only real difference there is that in Obama's arrangement, you would have, in addition to choice of private plans, there'd be a public plan, sort of like you'd be able to choose the post office or FedEx. And then, of course, we're kind of conflicted here, I think. On the one hand, we want choice. On the other hand, choice is confusing. And when it comes to insurance, it's easy to make what seems like a good choice, and then after the fact, you wished you'd bought the insurance that specifically covered the disease you got, but you didn't know you were going to get it.
Right.
So it's kind of like a gamble. Either one will help to clarify, I think, the choices available to people because they will set up arrangements where the subsidies will be much easier for people to understand, and the premiums that they would have to pay will be easier for them to understand.
Well, certainly the economic impacts are complicated enough, and it remains to be seen what impact there will be on public health with the adoption of either of these plans. Mark Pauly, thanks so much for joining us.
Very, very welcome. Thank you.
Mark Pauly is a health economist at the Wharton School. He spoke with us from Wayne, Pennsylvania. And now, headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. The Labor Department says that new applications for unemployment benefits dropped last week from a seven-year high, although claims remain at very high levels due to the struggling economy. So we're now looking at about 478,000 people. And the Labor Department also said that hurricanes Ike and Gustav were responsible for adding around about 20,000 claims on a seasonally adjusted basis. Wall Street appears headed for a strong open today. Stock markets around the world moved mostly higher one day after the Fed made a coordinated effort with other world banks to cut interest rates. And Syria officials have confirmed that they have detained two missing American journalists after they tried to enter the country illegally. So they're looking at 27-year-old Holly Camila and 23-year-old Taylor Luck. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And, you know, here's an economic history lesson. Back in the 70s, it wasn't depression people were so worried about. It was inflation. Yesterday, the federal funds rate, you may recall, stood at 1.5%. Well, that benchmark borrowing rate for banks in 1974 was more like 10%, while the Dow Jones Industrial Average was hovering around 600. There were massive job losses heading into the final months of 1974, and President Gerald Ford addressed a weary nation.
In his first inaugural address, President Franklin D. Roosevelt said, and I quote, "The people of the United States have not failed. They want direct, vigorous action, and they have asked for discipline and direction under our leadership."
President Ford dreamed of mobilizing the nation to work together to turn the economy around. With inflation rising despite a program of federal price controls, the federal government literally set the prices of all kinds of goods. Nothing was working. So the president decided to sign every American up as an inflation fighter.
A very simple enlistment form will appear in many of tomorrow's newspapers along with a symbol of this new mobilization, which I'm wearing on my lapel. It bears the single word, win. I think that tells it all.
Win, that'll do it. It stood for Whip Inflation Now. But of course, when he introduced it to the nation in his nationally televised speech, President Ford kind of botched the acronym.
My conclusions are very simply stated. There is only one point on which all advisors have agreed. We must whip inflation right now.
Whip inflation right now. That's Wern. Doesn't quite have the snap of win, but Americans got the point anyway. It was all about cutting costs on everything from energy to food. The president got positively giddy talking about the gardens Americans would plant to help out their grocery bills.
Do it yourself. Plant wind gardens for yourself or within your community. Pool other do-it-yourself skills, and you can.
But all the wind gardens and other do-it-yourself efforts didn't really work, and whip inflation now became a campaign joke. The only national consensus on the economy during the Ford administration was that Gerald Ford should leave the White House, and he did when Jimmy Carter took over in 1977.
But I took office a couple of weeks ago, in the middle of the worst economic slowdown of the last 40 years.
But the economy would do in Carter as well. The one-term president established an inflation czar who monitored prices and wages and expanded elements of the Republicans' price controls. In February of 77, the Dow Jones Industrial Average had made it to 950. The Fed funds rate had been cut in half to 4.7%. But still, inflation ground on.
Other nations will join and support us as we cut down our use of oil and increase our own production of energy.
But again, it was only a dream. Inflation wouldn't subside until well into the Reagan administration. By then, the Federal Reserve had raised the Fed funds rate up beyond 17%. Carter had no buttons to fight inflation. He did once officially ban his inflation czar from saying the word inflation. That's right. And reportedly, his frustrated advisor, a Cornell economist named Alfred Kahn, chose the word banana as a substitute.
We have no bananas. We have no bananas today. We got string beans and onions and big juicy lemon.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 9th, and Femi Okeh has just joined us, and she has the latest headlines. Femi.
Thanks, Adora. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Stocks seem ready to rebound today after a rally earlier in Europe. The Treasury is considering taking ownership of some U.S. banks to help strengthen Wall Street. And for Main Street, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says that Congress may have to go back in session to pass a second stimulus package. This one might be worth as much as $150 billion. President Bush has promised to veto any such legislation. And this has just been released. The jobless claims figures are dropping from a seven-year high as the impact from Hurricane Ike decreases. U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is calling on NATO allies to send either more troops or more money to the fight in Afghanistan. He wants to double the size of the Afghan army that takes both trainers and funds. And I'm following two stories from Ukraine today. In politics, Ukrainian President Viktor Yushchenko has set elections for December the 7th. It will be the third election in Ukraine in less than 3 years. Outside the political sphere, there's some extraterrestrial news being made in a field in Ukraine where scientists are hoping to make contact with aliens. I know it sounds a little strange, but there's a huge telescope that's set up that is set to beam information, 500 text messages and images off to a planet known as Gliese 581c. But one US scientist, his name is Seth Shostak, he's a senior astronomer from the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute in California.
SETI, that's the SETI program.
I should just say he's an astronomer.
Yeah, just stop there. You could say that.
He explained that it doesn't really matter if the aliens don't understand it. Here's Seth.
We're clever enough to build a radio transmitter. So if anybody's out there and they find that signal, even if they understand not a thing about it, they at least know that, you know, in the direction of that star system over there, there must be a planet with some pretty clever things on it.
So even if the aliens on planet Gliese 581c, they don't understand the language and the text messages that we're sending, at least they know that we're smart enough to actually
or annoying enough to send noise through space.
If we get a reply, it will be in 40 years' time.
And in Ukrainian.
if they're good enough.
Thank you. Thank you, Femi.
You're okay, welcome. I won't be following up that story, though.
I'm sure you will be. And I really hope that you will be.
We're going to move on to stories about real people. A fascinating story, actually, about Alaska's North Slope. Not about how much oil is there, but about the people who work in the barren tundra off the Arctic Ocean pulling up the oil. Joining us is writer Jean Marie Laskus, who is one of the few people to penetrate this very tight-knit, isolated world, which she wrote about for GQ magazine. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, you really described this as a hidden world, and you went in with some assumptions, but you came out with a totally different perception. What did you find?
Well, let's just say first the assumption I think anyone would have going into a place where you're living in, you know, minus 45 degree weather, these workers, you know, where it's perpetually dark for several months a year, and you live without families. They do two-week shifts out on the ice. You know, my sense going in was I sort of expected to pity these people. How did you get stuck with this job, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But instead found a group of pretty colorful characters who love it there, just love it.
I mean, you describe absolutely brutal conditions. You said perpetually dark, and it's a place, I love that sentence where you said it's a place where you have to leave your pickup running 24 hours a day, or you just won't simply get it started.
Oh, yeah, they all do. They just run.
So tell us about Turtle, Kung Fu, Brain, Two Dogs, and those are actual people.
Yeah, these are the guys on the rig. I focused on the oil workers, the actual roughnecks, they're called, who you know are doing the job, and they all have rig names that come from God knows where, you know, in their history together. They were just really fascinating characters in that they all had a reason for being there that had nothing to do with oil, and everything to do with maybe a family that they couldn't quite make work back home, so they had a family there that they made work. But it was a
so describe that, just to follow up on that.
Mm-hmm.
Give us an example. What wasn't working where they came from, and what was working in this very isolated community where they pull oil out of the ground?
Well, let's just take Two Dogs for example. He's probably my main character in this piece. You know, like so many of these guys, he had a really pretty severe history of addiction, a lot of addiction stories in this area, and I would say in a lot of Alaska in particular. And he just, you know, messed up a lot in his life and had a wife that he loved dearly and four kids and a history of abuse that made it so he couldn't be hugged. So he couldn't make the family work because he couldn't be touched. If he was touched, he'd break out in hives. But he goes up to the rig. He could run a family there of guys. These were like his sons. And it was easier, a lot easier. So, you know, for him it was a missing his family but not being able to do family.
And what are their days like?
Well, they work 12-hour shifts. And that would be, you know, it didn't matter whether it was morning, noon, or night because you could never tell. You could never tell what day it was, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You're either working or you're sleeping. You're working or you're sleeping. You know, on the North Slope, there is nothing there. To the eye, to our eyes of the lower 48 living in towns and cities, there is, I don't mean just nowhere to go, like just a truck stop. There are no truck stops. There's no community. There's no church. There's no nothing. You're stuck out there on the ice. So when your shift is over, you're basically going to bed and maybe watching some TV. There was nothing to do. You couldn't even go outside for a walk. It's too cold. So, the world gets tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter the longer you stay there.
It took you a long time to get there, to get into one of these companies to see what's happening. Why did you work so hard, and what were the obstacles you faced?
Well, the North Slope in general, it's run by the three major oil companies, BP, ConocoPhillips, and to some extent Exxon. There really has not been much written about it in any way beyond, you know, if some exciting spill happens, which is kind of rare up there, an oil spill happens, and you'll have reporters maybe allowed in to cover an event. But in terms of just staying there and you know, absorbing the culture, I don't know that it's been done. And they certainly did not want me there. You know, the attitude was, why would we do that? Why would we open ourselves up to anyone sort of seeing the way that we live here? But little by little, small independent companies have started to move in, and an independent company called Pioneer Natural Resources is the first independent operator up there, who built this tiny little island, 6-acre island in the ocean, and they were willing to allow me to come along.
But why was it so important for you to get there?
Well, you mean for me to write about this
exactly.
Subject? Well, I'm doing a lot of stories right now about just kind of the people who make America work, the people we're dependent on that we don't know. You know, we know we're dependent on oil. Where do we get the stuff? Who are the people getting it? These are actual human beings, you know, and we don't have any access to who they even are.
What's the one thing that you hope people who read your article learn about those people who are working in Alaska's North Slope?
I think that the one thing, this sounds kind of crazy, but I think that the one thing is to know that they exist, to know that there are people on the other end of this equation, that this isn't just some, you know, a bunch of machines that bring us this magic fluid that makes the world go around, that this is an industry filled with, you know, in some ways, and they're not made out to be heroes in my story, but it's certainly every sacrifice you can imagine in terms of just human comfort that these folks are living through.
Jean Marie Laskis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
She is a writer, and she wrote about the men who work on Alaska's North Slope, pulling that oil out of the ground for GQ. We're always on here at The Takeaway.
Back in the 70s, it wasn't depression people were worried about. It was double-digit inflation. We've been talking about a program President Ford created back then called WIN, Whip Inflation Now, and how Ford's administration handed out little WIN buttons.
Thanks for the piece on the WIN buttons. I still have mine. One thing that is probably was just as applicable then as it would be now is that if you turn WIN upside down, it's NIM, No Immediate Miracles.
More information about Ford on our website. We're also talking all day about health care. Do you think it's a right or a responsibility? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
Don't forget our election website, vote2008.thetakeaway.org. We got all kinds of stuff there. John Hockenberry is right here. It's The Takeaway.
I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
An economy under attack. Take me to your leader.
Please, Commander, you are our last hope.
It will take time and bipartisan leadership, cooperation and collaboration, as well as well-conceived and executed policies to overcome the challenges our nation is facing. And we will overcome them.
A galaxy on a quest for economic stability, and Paulson is the commander. Bankers in a meltdown, it turns out, can't be choosy. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 9th. And so I think I get this one, John. It's not just an international community. It's an intergalactic community.
Intergalactic. Absolutely. Good morning, Adora. What else we got going?
Economics is on the agenda. And we're going to also take a look at the U.S. moves in banking and real estate and how the fiscal turmoil will affect your or potentially affect your health care. Those stories are coming up. But first, we have some headlines.
Wall Street looks set for a strong open. The Dow Jones Industrial Average futures contract contract is up more than 150 points, and new unemployment numbers show jobless figures dropped last week. 20,000 fewer people applied for unemployment benefits. The numbers are still high. Previously, they were at the highest level since just after 9/11. European markets posted modest gains. Asian markets were more of a mixed bag after South Korea, Taiwan, and Hong Kong jumped on the interest rate cut bandwagon.
Our partner, the New York Times, reports this morning that the Treasury is considering following in Britain's footsteps and taking ownership stakes in U.S. banks. The Treasury is allowed to do that under the White House's $700 billion financial plan. Meanwhile, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson says he'll move quickly to buy up bad assets, but cautiously.
Every effort will require careful analysis, deliberation, and transparency, and some measure of patience from the American people as we create the most effective process possible.
Paulson says it will be several weeks before the program makes its first purchases. An SEC ban on short selling has ended today. Short selling is where investors bet on a company's value falling. Investors were critical of the SEC rule. Certain financial stocks rose after the ban, but may have fallen since.
We're going to have more on all those economic details, including the buying spree that the Treasury is expected to go on fairly soon. The Nobel Prize in Literature goes to French novelist Jean-Marie Gustave Leclésio. The presenters praised his diverse cosmopolitan writing. Europeans have dominated the category in recent years. The last American to win was Toni Morrison in 1993.
On the campaign trail, John McCain and Sarah Palin are together in Wisconsin. Barack Obama is in Ohio while Joe Biden swings through Missouri.
Tonight, the Phillies host the Dodgers in Game 1 of the National League Championship Series. In the American League, Boston takes on Tampa Bay. That's on Friday. The oil settled around $88 a barrel in Asian trading. What about health care? That's what we're talking about this morning. Is it a right or a responsibility?
Good morning. This is Marina. I'm a single mother of three. If we can assist Wall Street with $700 billion, we should take a couple of millions just to provide health care for everyone.
We're thinking about the candidates' health care plans today, distinguishing them. What do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Is it a right or a responsibility? Health care.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As we noted in the newscast, he's making a list and he's apparently checking it twice. The Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Paulson, with his $700 billion checking account, is about to go on a buying spree. Yes, he is kind of the Santa Claus of the global economy. But what is he going to buy? It appears this morning that among the things on the list are banks that the government will be permitted to buy under its new authority from the bailout plan. But what does it actually mean for the U.S. government to take an ownership stake in banks in return for offering capital to those same banks? Does it give the Treasury the right to take ownership of banks that are still thriving, for instance, and don't even need a handout from the government? Mark Landler joins us now. He's the New York Times international economics correspondent. Mark, thanks for being with us again.
Good morning.
This is a story that the Times is reporting, and it seems to follow similar steps taken in Britain yesterday. You know, the U.S. already seems to own a lot of financial assets at this point, from AIG all the way through to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. What would this add to the portfolio, shall we say?
Well, I guess the most important thing it would add is the ability to take what had been in the case of AIG and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, case-by-case decisions, and basically develop a systematic policy where the government could inject capital into banks, including banks that are not about to fail or in danger of failing, which is what you saw in the AIG case, in return for which the government would acquire an ownership stake. And the thinking behind it is that what you need to address to break the logjam in the credit market is the unwillingness, the inability of banks to lend money to each each other. And one of the most direct and quickest ways to do that is to inject capital into them to improve their balance sheets and hopefully persuade them to resume lending. This is what the British have done. It's what the Swedes and the Japanese did in previous banking crises. And it's something that a lot of experts have expected to be the eventual step the U.S. will take. And now we're basically getting indications that, indeed, this is emerging as the favored option among the ones that have been already put on the table through the large bailout plan.
You know, with some benefit today, we don't have crazy volatility on the markets all across the world, so we can step back a little bit. Are these measures, and let's take them in total now, including the bailout package, are these measures stopgap anomalies and will eventually go back to the way we did business before? Or are we seeing a really broad, almost century-long march of the federal government's intervention into the markets to the point that, you know, the markets actually are owners, part owners of the financial sector itself?
Well, there's no question that we're going to enter an era of profound change in regulation and probably greater government intervention in the financial system than we've seen in this country maybe ever. Although I never want to say ever, the Great Depression, there was a tremendous government role in turning around the economy. But what is interesting about this particular scenario is that if you look at other countries that have done it, notably Sweden, there is a precedent for governments going in, taking aggressive ownership stakes in banks, and then later when the situation stabilizes, and by later I don't mean a month later, but a couple of years later, the stakes are then sold, and sometimes sold at a reasonable profit. So it doesn't necessarily mean we have a permanently changed landscape, but certainly we have a landscape that's changed profoundly and for some period of time.
But Mark, at what point is it too much? How much is too much, and at what point is the market perhaps going to lose confidence that the government is going to be able to execute all of these things?
Well, I guess the question maybe ought to be asked, at what point is it enough? Because what we've seen so far is a flurry of measures, the most ambitious, most creative, most radical measures that anyone really contemplated. And the market's reaction to all of them so far before this morning was to continue to be paralyzed, to continue to be distrustful. And this particular action, it does have a precedent. It's not the first time anyone has ever tried it. It has worked in the past. And there is a growing belief that this may be the one thing you can do that's simple enough, it's relatively easy to understand, it's transparent, and it may be enough of a confidence booster. That doesn't mean, by the way, the government won't do the other things it was talking about doing. It will buy distressed mortgage assets from banks, which was, if you remember, the centerpiece of the bailout plan. And there will be some efforts to, mitigate losses on mortgages and foreclosures. So it's not that we won't be hearing about these two other options as well, but this particular one seems to be gaining a lot of traction in Washington and on Wall Street.
And so far the markets are stable, but the question is, confidence or not, will the arithmetic work out right, whether you're measuring credit default swaps at $62 trillion or more the subprime mortgage problem, which is in the billions, hundreds of billions? The question is, will $700 billion be more than a drop in the bucket? Mark Landler, international economics correspondent for The New York Times, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now we're going to talk about something that you might have missed in this week's presidential debate when Republican candidate John McCain made this proposal that was quite surprising to some.
As President of the United States, Alan, I would order the Secretary of the Treasury to immediately buy up the bad home loan mortgages in America and renegotiate at the new value of those homes, at the diminished value of those homes, and let people be able to make those payments and stay in their homes.
McCain's rival Barack Obama came out and said that would mean big losses to American taxpayers. It may not matter, though, because some say, or some believe, some argue, the bailout money may well be spent by the time either of them is in office. And joining us now is Brian Wingfield, Washington Bureau Chief of Forbes.com. Good morning, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Many were surprised to hear a Republican making this kind of proposal.
Right.
McCain's calling this the American Home Ownership Resurgence Plan. What is it?
Well, essentially, it's a proposal, as he mentioned in the debate, to buy about $3 billion worth of mortgages that have been foreclosed upon from lenders and borrowers directly. So that would go straight to the government's balance sheet.
And how would it work exactly?
Well, we don't have all the details. That's kind of the big question mark, the $300 billion question mark, I guess. Essentially, it would be very much like a New Deal type program where the government comes in and takes over mortgages directly from the borrower or the lender. Now, where we get that money, we don't know. He has said, or his campaign has said, that some of it could be used from that $700 billion in the bailout package, but I think Doug Holtzeek and his top economic advisor has also said that it could come from various government pots. But again, we just don't have the details on this program.
So it's all a bit fuzzy, but in terms of the bailout money, what's the argument is to be said that there won't be any come the end of January when one of them takes office?
Well, I think, first of all, the Treasury wants to do this right. I mean, they want to get it done quickly, but they've said that they have to do it right. So I think it's going to be several weeks before we see any checks cut or a figurative term, but I think any money go out to buy these troubled assets. But at the same time, they want to get as much out there as they possibly can. Now, the first $350 billion can be made immediately. There's $250 billion that can go straight away. Then the president has the authority to authorize another $100 billion. And then the remainder of that amount can be used at the president's discretion, but it has to be disapproved by Congress. So it doesn't have to be approved by Congress. Congress just has to say, no, we don't want this to go out. Even if Congress says that, the president has the right to veto that. So, you know, I think the government wants to get this money out as quickly as possible. I mean, I don't think it's in anybody's interest to hold on to this bailout money because, I mean, as we've seen just in the past month, what has happened to the economy, and it's flipped on its head. Who knows what could happen, you know, by January. So,
exactly. So there's a lot of uncertainty out there. And given that, what do you then make of McCain's proposal?
You know, I have to say, personally, I don't think this proposal is going to go anywhere. I think that it falls into the same league as the gas tax holiday that he proposed earlier in the summer. I mean, it's an interesting idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's gotten a lot of attention. But I think the economic landscape is going to change so much within the next 3 months that I don't think this is going to have much of a future.
Brian Wingfield, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Brian is the Washington Bureau Chief of Forbes.com. As for the election, we're talking about health care today. What do you think?
I don't think health care should be a right given to everyone because not everyone in the country works. A lot of people just live off the system, and people like me that work hard for a living shouldn't get the same health care with these guys that don't do anything.
So is health care a personal responsibility? Do you think the government has some kind of responsibility? And what's the in-between? What should you be doing? What should the government be doing? We want to hear your thoughts.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So imagine you're the president. Regarding health care, what would you do, socialize or privatize?
I lived overseas for a while, and I found that socialized medicine was great. I lived in New Zealand, and I think it's just because of money that we haven't done it. It's all about greed.
options on health care. It's a campaign issue, and it's something we're talking about this morning. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And health care, clearly one of those issues that the presidential candidates are going to be battling it out about. But there are also a growing number of Republican Senate candidates who find themselves in, well, a precarious predicament. A good example of that would be the mounting obstacles for U.S. Senator Elizabeth Dole. Now, she is one of the most well-known Republican women politicians in the country. And a year ago, she was a shoo-in for re-election. But her Democratic challenger, State Senator Kay Hagan, has been picking up some speed. Joining us now is Rob Christensen. He's a longtime reporter and columnist for North Carolina's News and Observer newspapers. And he's also the author of The Paradox of Tar Heel Politics, Personalities, Elections, and Events That Shaped Modern North Carolina. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning.
So what happened to Dole's lead?
Well, a lot of things happened. And the main thing is the national trends. Elizabeth Dole was recruited to run in 2002 by Karl Rove to replace the ailing Senator Jesse Helms. President Bush campaigned for Elizabeth Dole five times in 2002, which was the most of any candidate he campaigned for, with the exception of his brother Jeb Bush down in Florida. And this time, of course, Bush's numbers are in the tank. The president has not been on the scene on the campaign trail and won't be, obviously, with Elizabeth Dole. And Elizabeth Dole is facing a surprisingly tough challenge. A couple things going on here. One is that that North Carolina's economy, like the rest of the country, has been hurting. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, led by Senator Schumer, has pumped millions of dollars into Kay Hagan's campaign, which has helped equalize the funding in the race. Dole had a wide margin, and there have been pretty effective ads. I think the most effective ad.
We actually have one of those ads, because I was going to ask you, have things gotten, I don't know if nasty is the right word, but certainly intense. Let's listen to this ad.
I'm telling you, Liddy Dole is 93.
93?
Yep. She ranks 93rd in effectiveness.
After 40 years in Washington?
After 40 years in Washington, Dole is 93rd in effectiveness, right near the bottom.
I've read she's 92.
Did I just tell you she's 93?
No, 92% of the time she votes with Bush.
What's happened to the Liddy Dole I knew?
She's just not a go-getter. Like
so, Rob, clearly a jab at her age. You have, she's actually 72 years old, but the tone of that, is that a low blow?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, obviously. They're obviously making her age an issue. Of course, she's the same age as John McCain. But I think it also plays on the fact that she's a Washington figure. She's been, the 92-93 is a double-edged thing. It talks about her age, but it really is talking about some ratings have shown her as fairly ineffective. It's trying to show her as out of touch. She has always had a little bit of a problem of the carpetbagger issue. She was born and raised in North Carolina, but she spent her entire career in Washington.
And she came back out swinging. She's clearly not taking any of this laying down. Let's listen to an ad that she put together against Hagan.
They call her Fibber K. Hagan. Fib after fib, she tries to turn us against Elizabeth Dole. But we know Elizabeth has been consistently voted one of the 10 most admired women in the world.
So, Rob, K, a fibber, is that based on something particular?
There's been a whole series of attacks on Elizabeth Dole, and so they're coming back, and they're, of course, using a dog, and, of course, the imagery there is pretty self-evident. I think one of the interesting things is that when she ran in 2002, she ran against a man, Erskine Bowles, former Clinton White House chief of staff, and he was reluctant to go after her, in part because this is a socially conservative state, and it's the Southern lady sort of thing, and you have to be very careful going after a woman candidate. Now we have two women candidates, so the gender issue is no longer on the table, and that has allowed Kay Hagan to go after Dole's race.
And Rob, I'm just going to interrupt you there, because I want to bring in senior editor of Essence, Patrick Henry Bass, who's been watching this race closely for lots of reasons. But this time it is a different race for Senator Dole.
It is a very different race. What I'm really concerned about, what I wonder about, are Obama's coattails. Is Kay helping Obama or vice versa?
I think, you know, traditionally the Republican candidate has had coattails in North Carolina because the state hasn't gone Democrat for president since Jimmy Carter in 76. This time it's totally changed because North Carolina is a battleground state. So the thinking is that Obama, whether he wins the state or not, he has made it competitive, and he has a huge ground operation in this state, and that he probably brings in another 2%. So if this race goes into Election Day tied, then there's probably the tie goes to the Democrat, in this case, Hagan.
One more question. What is Obama getting right that Harvey Gantt did not when he ran against Jesse Helms in the early 90s?
Well, of course, this was a long time ago, and the state's changed. A lot of people moved into the state, and also racial attitudes have changed. And also, Gantt was running against an incumbent, and
Helms was in the picture. Right. That was the big one.
Yeah. That was the big one.
Wow. Rob, one we've seen in Georgia where African-American registration is through the roof. I'm wondering if that's going on there, and if the fact that Charlotte is such an important center in this whole banking crisis that's going on has also influenced this race.
Well, if you look at voter registration increases since January, there's an 8-to-1 advantage Democrat over Republican in North Carolina.
Wow.
And that's part of that's African-American, of course, but it's also a lot of young people. There's a lot of colleges, universities here. Yes, and the second part of your question, Charlotte is, I guess, the second largest banking center in the country, and there's a lot of concern about one of the major business institutions in the state and whether that will survive, and if so, will there be large layoffs and so forth. So, but that is, we've already had that discontent across the state in
right.
textile mills and so forth. Now we're seeing it in some of our blue chip newer industries like banking.
Rob Christensen, thanks so much. He's a columnist for North Carolina's The News and Observer, and he's the author of The Paradox of Tar Heel Politics, the personalities, elections, and events that shape modern North Carolina. Patrick Henry Bass is going to stick around with us, and we are also talking today about health care. What do you think about it?
I think nobody should make money off of health care. Nobody should make money off of somebody else's cancer.
So should the government be responsible for your health insurance, or should you be responsible for your health insurance? Give us your thoughts at 8778-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 9th, and we have the latest headlines for you from Femi. Okay, Femi.
Thanks, Adora. The markets have just opened at 28 minutes to the top of the hour. Open for 2 minutes. How are the markets doing, Adora?
The Dow's up about 126 points, and the S&P up about 12 points, so basically flat.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Meanwhile, with some other economic news, Citigroup and Wells Fargo have two more days to negotiate who will own Wachovia. A district judge granted an extension. Both groups are concerned about acquiring low-value assets from Wachovia. In Iceland, authorities say they will take over the country's last remaining independent bank. It's the third such takeover in recent days. Iceland has suspended trading on its stock exchange until Monday. The SEC's ban on short selling is over. The ban was intended to be a timeout to allow markets time to recover from recent turmoil, but most market watchers say it wasn't very effective. The state of California is changing its marriage license. They're putting the words bride and groom back in, and they have been replaced with the gender-neutral Party A and Party B. That's not very romantic. But many couples protested, arguing they wanted to have the option to define themselves in the traditional manner. So now the boxes will be blank and then you can fill in as necessary. So everybody will be very happy.
Will they, you think?
Well, I suppose,
find something
on that priority list of things that are important in California.
That's interesting.
Interesting.
It's important. You don't want to be called Party A and Party B. That's not romantic.
I'm Party B.
Meanwhile,
staying out of bankruptcy court as a state is probably important, too.
Oh, you're splitting hairs here.
Well, it's all about the changing gender roles in American culture. Femi, thank you for being
on top
of it for us.
I like to bring you all the news you can use.
Yeah, good luck at the wedding. It's a case of garbage in, garbage out, you might say. But in 2002, the Help America Vote Act was supposed to trim the rolls of inaccurate entries and more rationalize the process of voter registration. But it appears that list modifiers in various battleground states could be responsible for tens of thousands of voters not actually being on the rolls. Joining me to talk about this story from the New York Times is Ian Urbina, who's a New York Times reporter calling us from Washington. Explain how decisive this could actually be. It involves many, many potential voters, it seems.
It does. I mean, it's decisive for two reasons. Its scope, as you said, there are tens of thousands that seem to either have been blocked from the rolls or have been removed from the rolls in the first place. And then it's also decisive possibly because it's affecting at least six swing states. And there are two different types of problems we found. One is it seems like from the data, large numbers of people have been removed from the rolls in a time frame that federal law forbids. And then the other problem we found was that it seems that large numbers of people are having their registration applications checked in ways that are not appropriate and in violation of federal law, and therefore people may be prevented from getting on the rolls in the first place in ways that are not legal.
Well, let's do the math for a minute. I mean, according to your reporting, for every voter added to the rolls, and we've heard all kinds of stories about how Barack Obama's candidacy and the nature of this entire election campaign has really increased registration, but for every one new voter on the rolls, two have been removed under the Help America Vote Act of 2002. Now, what could possibly be wrong with making voter registration lists more accurate, and is it possible that all these people removed were actually appropriately removed?
Mm-hmm. The problem with removals is twofold, when you do it and how you do it. You're not supposed to be conducting large-scale removals in the 90 days before any major election because it doesn't give you enough time for there to be oversight to make sure that those removals are legitimate and not partisan. So the number you cite and most of the numbers in the story are within this 90-day window when federal law says you can't be doing this, you can't be adjusting the list in this way. Overall list maintenance, meaning making sure that your voter rolls are accurate, is very important. And getting dead people and felons and duplicates off the list is extremely important, so much so that last year the DOJ pushed a bunch of states with threat of litigation on the matter. But again, when you get down to the final moments before an election, that's when all sort of adjustments of this sort should stop.
And Ian, do you think this purging, is it just a bureaucratic snafu, or do you think it's driven by partisan politics in an effort to give one party an edge over the other?
I mean, from what we can tell, it doesn't seem to be a partisan effort. But I do think it's probably two things. One, sort of growing pains as the country attempts to standardize and centralize how these lists are maintained on the state level. And so in the handoff between local election officials to state election officials, sometimes mistakes are made. And two, a general lack of knowledge by the states and the local election officials of what federal law says they can and cannot do.
Well,
those seem to be the biggest reason.
Well, you focused on this 90-day window, which is apparently, I mean, some of the states you looked at are in violation of federal law. But the other issue, which is actually a little more complex, is trying to take voter registration rolls and reconcile them with, like, federal Social Security lists in terms of whether people are still alive, whether they're at the right address. Why is it a problem using the Social Security list?
So a registration application comes in, and the goal is to check it off of other databases to see if the information for John Smith on the application corresponds with the information that exists in another database. The rules are you're supposed to, whenever possible, use a driver's license or state-issued ID first and on the application, and thus when you do that check, you're supposed to be checking the application off of the statewide driver's license database.
And instead, what's happening?
Instead, what's happening is these numbers seem to indicate that huge numbers of these applications are not being checked off the statewide database, but off of the federal Social Security database. And because that federal database and the way that they use it, election officials use it, is more prone to error and flagging things that shouldn't be flagged, it's raised concerns that a lot of these numbers may have been flagged, these applications may have been blocked in ways that are not in agreement with federal law.
So a compromised list means that you have a compromised voter registration roll, potentially, and the feds have actually ruled on this, or at least have commented on this in your story. Finally, what are the states where this has had an impact or could potentially have an impact?
Well, like we said, there are two issues. There's folks not getting on the rolls who should and folks being taken off the rolls who shouldn't. And between those two concerns, you know, there are six, you know, swing states.
Colorado, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Nevada, and North Carolina, all battleground states. So this story is sort of magnified in importance as a result of that. Ian Urbino, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ian Urbino is a New York Times reporter in the Washington Bureau. He spoke with us from D.C.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And this morning, not long ago, the 2008 Nobel Prize for Literature was announced, and the winner is a French writer, Jean-Marie Gustave Le Clézio. He not only gets a gold medal, but also a $1.4 million check. Joining us to talk about this win is Patrick Henry Bass, who is a senior editor at Essence Magazine, a book editor. And Patrick, you say this is a big surprise.
This is an upset. I'm sure right now Amos Oz wants a recount of the jury. Like, the short list was Amos Oz. It was Haruki Murakami, the Japanese writer. It was Adonis, who everyone thought was going to get the Nobel Prize. Who's
the Syrian poet.
Phenomenal. Mario Vargas, let me get it right. Mario Vargas Llosa.
Llosa.
The Peruvian writer was seen as a shoo-in. There was a lot of controversy over this, you know, particular Nobel in literature for 2008 because of, you know, one of the Swedish judges who
let's
said some
get to that in
words.
1 second, but let's talk about Le Clézio, who is described by the Nobel Committee as someone who's been writing since they were 7 or 8. There was a survey in the 90s done in France that named him among 13% of the population as the most gifted French writer alive. So quite a following, at least there
right,
in France.
Right. JMG, as we can say. John, how would you want to say his last name? Le Clézio. He's published at least 30 books in France. And the French do revere their writers. You know, they really do, in ways that sometimes I think Americans don't.
But also, the Nobel Prize for Literature has never been a popularity contest. I mean, the Nobel Committee takes it as a matter of honor to introduce writers to the world of readers as much as honoring writers who are blockbuster famous already.
Exactly, although Ernest Hemingway won a Nobel Prize, you know, William Faulkner won a Nobel
Toni
Morrison, the last American to win a Nobel Prize in 1993. Doris Lessing had always done pretty well in terms of sell.
But Kenzaburo Oe, Japanese writer, but introduced to the world as a result of the Nobel.
Harold Pinter had no problem getting work done, and he won a Nobel Prize as well. So it's mixed, I would say.
Grisham's Nobel, you know, was
Nicholas Sparks is next. I predict that.
Let's quickly talk about the intrigue here, of course, was not only who was going to win, but from which country the winner would come from, and why was that even an issue?
Because of a the jury never reveals themselves. It's quite anonymous, but Horace Engelhardt, I guess, one of the jurors for the Nobel Committee, you know, came out and basically called American writers hacks, you know, essentially, you know, and it would say that American writers are too provincial, because people have wondered for the longest time why Philip Roth or Joyce Carol Oates, who have now become the Susan Lucci's of the Nobel Prizes.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Poor Joyce Carol Oates. She's staggering.
She's
if she heard
working
that.
At three because books right now. There'll be three books in 2009 from Joyce Carol Oates.
Essentially, he said that American writers are inhibited by their own ignorance.
Well, I think it was unfortunate what he said, but I think it brings up a very good point. Like, if you look at most of the major publishing houses, there are Nobel candidates like Chinua Achebe, who's never won a Nobel Prize, you know, a Nigerian writer. But it's not as if the American writers, Don DeLillo, Joyce Carol Oates, Philip Roth, is not as if they are moving in that direction,
right,
towards the Nobel Prize.
Patrick,
because it's
Henry,
all about the sales.
Patrick Henry Bass, you're going to stick with us.
Yes,
senior
I will.
Editor from Essence Magazine.
Talking about Nobel winner Jean-Marie Gustave Leclésio.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, October 9th. Excuse me. Pardon me, please. Time for the latest headlines from Femi Okeh, who's just joined us.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Just in, a frog from Adora's throat.
Yeah, we're talking about healthcare on The Takeaway.
Yeah. You mustn't laugh. She's going to choke to death. The markets opened this morning with the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P up more than 1%. The government says that new applications for unemployment benefits dropped by 20,000 last week, down from a 7-year high, though the weak economy still means claims are at higher than usual levels. Insurance giant AIG is getting some more help from the Fed. It announced yesterday it will loan nearly $38 billion more to the insurer. That's on top of last month's $85 billion government bailout.
Well, they can afford some more massages, then. That's good. Great. Excellent.
It's going to be a good conference next year. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is laying out a new strategy for the war in Afghanistan, NATO allies today. Gates will call for improved economic aid and an intensive plan to target Taliban-linked drug lords. The winner of the 2008 Nobel Literature Prize is French novelist Jean-Marie Gustave Leclésio. And finally, if you are struggling to keep up with the twists and turns of the economic crisis, I know we've been really helping here at The Takeaway, but you also need to take a look at quietlibrary.com. The Comedy Group has a brilliant explainer for the financial crisis, so let me set the scene. It's that time in a little boy's life when he sits down for a father-son chat.
Sometimes when a market loves a security very much, it doesn't notice when that security has become totally worthless. And then when it doesn't want to say anything.
Sort of like how you tell mommy she looks good even when she's wearing something silly.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly it.
You can see the...
Take your internet privileges away from me.
You can see the full explain at quietlibrary.com. You will be laughing through your tears.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So this just in, it's not actually news, but there are estimated to be about 6 billion people on the planet. Who's surviving? Only the strong survive. Well, that's what natural selection would say, but... I think not. Steve Jones is a professor of genetics at University College London, and he says, in fact, life expectancy means that natural selection, the major engine of evolution, is dormant in the human species at this point in time. Evolution has stopped because the strong are not the ones who survive in the community of human beings these days. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
What does it mean that the strong don't survive? Natural selection is switched off and we aren't evolving anymore.
Okay, well, let's step back just a little bit and ask what natural selection is, okay? Natural selection, I often think of as a factory for making almost impossible things. The eye, the elbow, the appendix, they all come from natural selection. And the process turns on differences. Natural selection is inherited differences in the ability to reproduce. And if there are lots of differences around, there's plenty of potential for natural selection. If there are no differences around, and I argue actually that in the developed world at least, and in fact across much of the globe, there are very few differences now of that kind around, then natural selection has no fuel and it can't work.
Now, is this a speculative observation that you're making, or is there something about the cells and the transmission of DNA in human species right now that indicates something has switched off?
Well, it's almost childishly simple. I've had lots of sort of hate mail from people who say I'm crazy, and I may well be, but I'm not crazy about this particular item.
It's all the other stuff you're crazy about, yeah.
I tell my undergraduate students in their first lecture, look to the person to your left and the person to your right, and two out of every three of you will die for reasons connected with the genes you carry. And that's approximately speaking correct. And they look a bit glum at that. And then I say, well, don't worry about it, cheer up, because if I'd been speaking in Shakespeare's time, two out of three of you would be dead already. And in Darwin's time, even 1859 or so, one out of two would be dead. So in the 16th century, two-thirds of all British babies were dead by the time they were 21. Nowadays, something like 98 or 99% of all babies survive. So there are no differences anymore. We all stay alive until we're old enough to reproduce. In the old days, many of those babies died for genetical reasons. They had genes that made them susceptible to cholera or to cold or to starvation, but now we all stay alive. No differences.
Okay? And would you say that healthcare makes life less arduous and therefore makes natural selection or genetic difference less of a factor in whether people survive or not?
Sure. Various things have helped. Healthcare has helped, of course. Some sewage, sewers have helped. Reduction in violence, which used to be far worse than it is today, has helped. There's not much starvation anymore. They've all helped. But what they've done is to make the central point is we all stay alive for long enough to reproduce. But, of course, it's a two-part exam. And the second paper is maybe more fun to sit, but the range of marks is much, much higher, because in order to pass on your genes, you have to find a mate and persuade him or her to collaborate with you in the messy task of producing excess DNA. Okay.
Right, which we would call progeny. Well, let me turn to my fellow humans here in the studio to see if they back you up on this issue of evolution being stopped. Adora?
Steve, question for you. Are you saying that scientists and doctors know so much about the ways that genes and the way that our DNA works that you can say with certainty that we've developed as far as we're going to go and you know that there's going to be no changes possible in the future?
No, I mean, that's too strong a statement. I mean, that's two different statements. I mean, first of all that matters are these figures about difference. Where they come from is neither here nor there. To be frank, scientists, geneticists know almost nothing about the way in which genes work. Occasionally we delude ourselves that we know a bit, but in all frankness, we're looking over the edge of an abyss of ignorance. But as long as everybody stays alive long enough to have children and has roughly the same number of children, then there is no opportunity for natural selection. It cannot work. So you don't need to know the mechanisms. You just need, don't worry about the mechanisms. Ask about the figures, and they're straightforward.
Is there a minimum? This is Patrick Bass here. Is there a minimum number of children or a maximum number of children that could?
That's the second part of the argument. We all stay alive effectively until we're old enough to reproduce. If you look around the world and look into the past, historically it was the case that there was a massive amount of variation in the number of children that particularly men had. Now, women, of course, are limited by simple biology as in the number of kids they can have. But men, in principle, if they can persuade somebody to collaborate with them, could have any number. Mohammed bin Laden, who's Osama's father, had 22 wives and 53 children.
He's very highly evolved.
Osama himself, last time we counted them, had 5 wives and 22 children. I picked up one guy who was called Mullah Ismail the Cruel of Morocco. who admitted to having had 888 children. And that's a lot.
I know Dennis Rodman's father had like 23 kids.
Oh, my
God. They're highly evolved.
Dennis Rodman. Let me ask about...
Let me just finish that argument.
Sure.
If one guy has 22 wives, then there are 21 other guys out there who don't have any wives at all. So there's a massive variation in the number of children. You look nowadays, and that's all gone. Over
right.
most of the world. Most people have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 children. That's it. No differences. No more chance for natural selection.
Last question, Steve. Is it possible that humans are developing not in the genetic, traditional sort of evolutionary way, but are interacting with machines and technology, and that this sort of hybrid machine-human domain is where humans are doing most of their development now?
Yes, for sure. I mean, we're doing it now. We're actually doing something almost miraculous, is that we're talking to each other across the Atlantic. You tend to forget how amazing that actually is. And the odd thing about human evolution is actually, if you look backwards, how little of it there's been in physical terms. If an early modern human came and sat on the tube next to me in London, in the rather rough part of London in which I live, I probably wouldn't notice. I mean, he might be covered in furs and grunting, but this is central London, what do you expect?
Go to Brixton, you can find that, sure.
So it's not physical change that's made us, it's mental change, and it's mental change that will make the future.
And is there precedent for that kind of evolution in other species?
I don't think so, really. I mean, people are, you know, there's a lot of controversy about the claim that we share 98% or so of our DNA with chimpanzees. Well, maybe we do, but we're not 98% chimpanzee. We're not chimpanzee at all.
Right.
We're entirely human. And actually, to me, the theory of evolution makes me feel much more unique and human and special than I would have felt without the theory of evolution, because you can see how much we've stepped outside the arena of Darwinian natural selection and so on.
We've done it on our own.
The rest of life.
Right, we've done it on our own. Steve Jones, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Feeling special there in London, Steve Jones is a professor of genetics at University College. And Patrick Henry Batts, a senior editor at Essence Magazine. We got to go, it looks like.
We do, and I just want to say, John, I think you're special.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I'm going to start crying here. Here's your takeaway.
There are two issues. There's folks not getting on the rolls who should, and folks being taken off the rolls who shouldn't.
People being removed from voting rolls. That's New York Times reporter Ian Urbina.
And we want to hear what you think about health care options. We've been talking about that on the show today, and we'll continue to talk about issues that are in the middle of the presidential campaign this year.
And the takeaway.org is our website. That's where you go. You know, don't stop being special, Adora Udoji. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.